Chapter 3. Let Them Die. Arzek Unbound. Cruelty. Hathor Mart was well aware of the lesser mental capacity of mortals, but this was beyond the pale. The old man before him was trembling in fear, holding himself upright with a wooden staff carved in the form of an elongated viper. Despite his physical frailty, he looked up at Hathor Mart with a defiance that was quite out of character in those facing transhumans. His name was Felix Tefra, and he was the elected spokesman for this horticultural collective on the fertile slopes of Mount Kailash. Dormant for millennia, Morningstar's geomagnetic upheaval had transformed the serene mountain into a rumbling powder keg on the verge of a catastrophic eruption. Tefra stood before his people, some 500 agri-labourers and techs who were ignoring all sense and reason by refusing to be airlifted to safety in the stormbirds of the Thousand Suns and Iron Warriors. The isolated community was little more than a score of simple portal-framed structures with corrugated roofs. It possessed only the bare minimum of technology required to operate the irrigation systems and nutrient atomizers of its stepped fields. A winding rail track led back down the mountain, but Hathor Mart didn't think it had been used in years. He tapped the Legion insignia upon his shoulder guard with his gauntlet. "I have been tasked with bringing you to safety," he said.
"Yeah, and we thank you," said Tefra. "But your efforts were unnecessary. We are..."
Tefra's words were cut off by a hacking coughing fit. He bent double and would have collapsed but for his staff. When he straightened and took his hand from his mouth, it was wet with black phlegm. Hathor Mart eased a measure of his psychic senses outwards, his perception of the man's biology superior to any Narthesium. Tefra's lungs were all but dissolved by months of breathing pyroclastic ash from the volcano's smouldering peak. Reaching out to place a hand upon Tefra's shoulder, Hathor Mart let his power, his Pavoni power, flow into the man's flesh. It threaded damaged blood vessels all the way into his chest, where it renewed damaged bronchioles and purged the lung tissue of toxic materials. Tefra's breathing eased almost instantly, and he looked up at the legionary in wonderment.
"Come back with us, and you can all be healed," said Hathor Mart.
Tefra's wonderment fled his face, and he took a step back. Hathor Mart had seen that look before, in the eyes of enemies trying to kill him. Surely this man would not be so stupid as to attempt something so obviously suicidal.
"Cease your temptations," hissed Tefra,
his fists clenched in anger.
"Leave our sacred mountain right now."
His voice quavered, rich with giddy elation, as if he had passed some sort of test by spitting in the face of Hathor Mart's gift, as though dying here was the culmination of some long-awaited fulfillment.
"You are aware of Magos Tankorix's readings, yes?" said Hathor Mart, attempting another tack.
He held out the slate upon which the Mechanicum's data, indicating Mount Kailash's inevitable fate, was clearly displayed.
"This volcano is going to explode. Not just erupt and pour molten lava down its flanks, but explode. This mountain is going to cease to exist."
He was careful to enunciate every syllable, lest there be any misunderstanding.
"My men and I have orders to bring you and your people to Kalena for immediate evacuation."
Tefra shook his head.
"We are staying. That is an end to the matter."
Hathor Mart let his awareness spread throughout the men and women gathered behind Tefra. He felt their determination to remain here. A blind righteousness impervious to anything so trivial as facts or reason.
"You're all going to die," said Hathor Mart,
struggling to contain his anger in the face of such willful stupidity.
"Is that what you want?"
"It is not about what we want," said Tefra. "It is the will of the Stormlord. We will soon stand in radiance at his side."
The man's foolishness beggared belief. Hathor Mart laughed in his face.
"The Storm Lord! Do you realize how ridiculous that sounds? You are willing to die and consign everyone here to death over a folk tale?
You dare insult our faith,
said Tephra. When your faith is ridiculous, risks the lives of my men, and will get everyone here killed.
Absolutely. Then we have nothing further to talk about,
said Tephra, turning and rejoining his people. Hathor Mart watched incredulous as they made their way to their dirt-encrusted homes. He sighed, his anger turning to resignation, and turned back to the waiting Stormbirds, two in the crimson livery of the Thousand Suns, and five in the steel-dust yellow and black of the Iron Warriors. Obax Sakeo marched out to greet him.
"What's happening?"
asked the Iron Warrior.
"Why are they not boarding the gunships?"
Hathor Mart climbed the assault ramp of his Stormbird. "They're not coming," he said.
"What? Why not?"
"They don't want our help. They want to stay." Hathor Mart felt Obax Sakeo's confusion discolour his aura. The Iron Warrior did not have the imagination to comprehend such illogical behaviour. Truth be told, Hathor Mart was little better equipped to understand it. "Ignorance is nothing to be ashamed of," he said. "It can be undone by learning. But deliberate stupidity irritates me." Hathor Mart looked to the mountaintop. Boiling clouds of ash and lightning raged around the summit. Bands of purples, pinks, and sick yellows smeared across the buckling sky. His scrying powers were weak in comparison to his newfound potency in biomancy. But Hathor Mart needed no seer sight to know that the volcano would soon obliterate every living thing within hundreds of kilometres.
"They will all die here," said Obax Sakeo.
"Yes, they will."
"So what are we to do?"
"We let them," snapped Hathor Mart. The street was full of screams. Bodies lay at awkward angles. The ground was slick with blood. Men and women ran from their attackers, but bullets and blades met them at every turn. Husbands sheltered wives, and mothers sheltered children. The sons of Shaitan showed no mercy, turning their weapons on the young and the old, the strong and the weak. Araman's first shot all but obliterated a man carrying a weapon with a long perforated barrel. The man had killed at least a dozen people with indiscriminate fire, chanting a heathen catechism with each pull of the trigger. His body came apart, blown open by the explosive power of Araman's mass-reactive bolt shells. His second shot ripped through three men in a welter of shattered bone and pulped organs. The deafening echoes of bolter fire overshadowed all other sounds, and every head turned at the deafening reports. People threw themselves to the ground, crawling behind what little cover the streetscape offered. The gold-robed killers turned their guns on the two legionaries. Bullets sparked from their armour, but such low-powered weapons could do little more than scratch the paint from their plates. A bolt shell detonated, and another gunman was ripped apart from the inside. Araman saw mercury-bright halos of zeal and certitude surrounding the murderous men and women. His seer sight was better than any reticule on his helm visor. His targets were picked out unmistakably. He fired twice more, killing another two attackers. Forex matched his movements, advancing at his right shoulder. He fired with the metronomic regularity of a forge hammer, putting foes down with every shot. They waded through screaming refugees, twin giants with fire spitting from their weapons. A man wearing a blood-stained fright mask rose to his knees. A ricocheting fragment had ripped away most of the right side of his torso, leaving him hideously misshapen. He screamed as he fired a blitzing stream of high-caliber shells. They burst into flame an instant before impact, as Araman surrounded himself and Forex with a layer of superheated air. He extended his pyri thought form and hurled the man backwards, his golden robes ablaze. His screams were abruptly cut off, as searing fires dragged the oxygen from his lungs and consumed his flesh with phosphic speed. He felt surprise flow from Forex, but spun around as his corvidae senses flickered with a jagged vision of the statue upon which the demagogue had hectored the refugees. There. Two masked men in golden robes with an Imperial Army-issue rocket launcher primed and ready to fire. He yelled a warning as the gunner pressed the launch trigger. The rocket streaked towards Forex.
The Iron Warrior saw it coming. He braced and bent into the incoming ordnance with a defiant roar. The warhead impacted dead center on his shoulder guard, exploding on impact with a percussive hammer blow. Ahriman threw an enclosing kine barrier around Forex. A storm of razed fragments engulfed the Iron Warrior, but remained trapped within Ahriman's psychic shield. The two men bent to reload their weapon with a speed that spoke of professional training, but they had already taken the best shot they were ever going to get. Ahriman pushed his thoughts into the eighth enumeration, the most warlike posture of his fellowship, and poured his psychic power into their mortal physiology. They screamed, clawing the flesh from their bones, as superheated blood aerosolized from every pore in a stinking red mist. Skin slid like melted wax, bones bent and snapped. Ahriman let the power of the great ocean bleed out, exhaling as his combat instincts sought fresh threats. He registered no more gunfire or screams of terror. Weeping and pain were all that remained. He blinked away freeze-frame after-images of half-remembered truths, a corollary to such reckless expenditure of power. A brother lost to a terrible curse, a pain so great his mind fled from its memory, a great and terrible god reaching deep inside him to push the horror down into the deepest vault within his mind. Memories close to the surface and yet so far out of reach. Repercussive pain settled in his marrow, and confusion shrouded Ahriman's thoughts. His mind rebelled at being forced to bear such a burden. A scorched gauntlet steadied him as he swayed.
"Thank you, brother," he said.
His vision grayed at the edges, and he knew not which of his brothers aided him.
"I have not wielded such power since Byzant."
"How did you do all that?"
asked Forex. The interior of the Shirai Maveth was not at all what Athava had expected. Though there had been hints of considerations beyond the practical in the outward design of the fortress, they had been mere tasters for its interior. The spaces within were artfully formed, and as exquisitely detailed as the dragon palaces of Terror. Its walls were polished smooth as marble, and lit with recessed lumen strips. Yet the interior's clean simplicity sacrificed nothing of its defensive nature. Every screw stair turned to the left as it descended, and every onward passageway was laced with blind murder holes and hidden sally ports. Perturabo led them to a vaulted chamber deep in the heart of the mountain, a grand hall of gleaming marble veined with gold. Hard-wired servitors labored at banks of cogitators, and spectral veils of noospheric data shimmered before cliques of Mechanicum adepts, conversing in the staccato cadences of lingua technis. Three of its walls were hung with decorative tapestries, large enough to fly from the armored carapace of a Titanicus war engine. The fourth was inset with a wide ocular screen that put Athava in mind of the Picts he had seen, showing the bridge of the Imperator Somnium. Towards the rear of the chamber, wide steps led to a raised mezzanine area, where Perturabo had set his command table. Magnus followed his brother up to a space that had the feel of a workshop, the air redolent of hot metal, grease, and craft. Sheet-covered workbenches lined walls hung with a host of artificer's tools, and the purpose of a great many were not immediately apparent. Two iron warriors stood at the command table in the center of the space, haptically shifting data manifests between glowing tags of starship designations. From the crimson stains in their auras, their discussions had been heated. They looked up as Perturabo arrived and stood to attention. Perturabo took in the details of the plotter table with a glance and gave a curt nod, indicating Magnus and his warriors should join him. The volume of data presented on the plotter table was bewildering. Loading rates, trip times, cargo capacities, fuel reserves, fleet rotations, population influx, food levels, water supply, billeting arrangements, and hundreds more variables that played into the evacuation equation. Even Athava, who prided himself on his analytical nature and capacity for the unforgiving arithmetic of war, found himself struggling to process the ocean of information displayed.
"My two senior warsmiths," said Perturabo,
indicating the two iron warriors sifting the data.
Harkor and Barban Falk.
To Athava's eyes, the former had the look of a brawler, thickly wasted and with the majority of his muscle mass layered over his shoulders. A flicker of red danced before Athava's eyes, a corvidae sense of bloody destiny. Falk, however, was finely balanced, and Athava sensed he was a warrior who might achieve greatness.
Athava, my senior librarius, and Phocis Takar, one of my first fellowship captains, said Magnus.
Librarius? You still think that's a good idea?
Asked Perturabo.
I do, said Magnus, and Sanguinius agrees with me.
Tread lightly, brother, said Perturabo. What happened on Bezant travelled farther than you think. These are uncharted realms. Be sure you know what lies beneath.
I will do as you advise and temper my researches with caution, replied Magnus.
And Athava felt the lightest brush of psychic influence from his Primarch, so subtle he was unsure if he'd felt it at all.
Now to business, brother. Tell me of the evacuation's progress. Are you on schedule?
Perturabo blinked and looked up at his brother's use of you, but said nothing. If Magnus noticed his brief irritation, he chose not to acknowledge it.
Barely, and we have little margin for delays, said Perturabo,
turning his attention to the plotter table once more. The Primarch called up the manifests and fleet registries for the Legion ships anchored within the upper atmosphere. Data streamed from each entry, a cascade of energy demands, orbital vectors and cargo capacities.
Your ships are burning fuel at a prodigious rate by coming so close to the pull of Morningstar's gravity, noted Athava. They are, agreed Falk. It's a necessary trade-off between fuel consumption and overall trip time for the transatmospheric vessels. Even a few tens of kilometres less of a round trip makes a considerable difference to the evacuation timetable.
Perturabo pulled up a host of schematics, spinning wireframe diagrams of the various transorbital shuttle variants available to the evacuation effort.
Leaving aside the Lux Ferrum, the typical capacity for the transorbital conveyors available to us is in the region of 300 people. Our surface-to-orbit operations can clear around 200 launches every day, bearing approximately 65,000 people off-world. And that gives us a baseline requirement of needing to run 30 days of constant surface-to-orbit flights without interruption to get everyone off-world. And that's without factoring in flight time, air traffic bottlenecks, refueling, or ongoing maintenance. And it takes no consideration of loading and unloading evacuees at either end. Working to best-case margins, my initial timetable demands 2 Terran months to complete operations. We shave some time off that, as efficiency scales up with repetition, but we'll be doing very well if we get it much below my initial estimate. And that, of course, assumes everyone cooperates and is ready to be moved off Morningstar at regular intervals.
Magnus smiled. Oh, I see now why this world needs you.
It needs us, brother, said Perturabo. Both our legions are required to make this work.
My lord Perturabo, said Athava. Might I make an observation?
Of course, said Perturabo. You see a flaw?
Athava hesitated, well aware of how fluid the foundations were beneath him. Though he had been part of the Great Crusade for a few years only, Perturabo's fearsome reputation for logistical brilliance was already well known. Perhaps, he said.
Well, spit it out! We're on a tight enough timetable without having to stand on 15th Legion rituals.
Athava nodded and dismissed the rotating schematics of the transorbital shuttles with a swipe of his hand. He pulled up the fleet registries once more, highlighting each vessel's passenger capacity with haptic gestures.
The 4th and 15th Legion fleets comprise enough civilian craft to accommodate between 40 and 60,000 evacuees per vessel. We have 31 such ships between us, meaning we have capacity for, on paper, 1.65 million people.
Yeah, I can do arithmetic, said Perturabo. What's your point? even after all that has befallen it. Morningstar's most recent census puts its population at just over 2 million, said Athava. Even by stretching supplies, space, and available time to breaking point, we cannot evacuate everyone from Morningstar.
I am well aware of that, Athava, said Perturabo. Sadly, not everyone will survive to reach orbit and safety. We've already seen civil disobedience, riots, and people who simply don't want to leave.
Then a great many people are going to die, said Athava.
A lot of people will end up dead anyway, no matter what we do, put in Harkor. There's no way anyone can organize the mass evacuation of an entire planet without loss of life.
Why would anyone not want to leave a doomed world? Asked Phocis Takar. It makes no sense.
Hathor Maat and others have reported instances of the populace refusing to relocate in the face of certain death, said Magnus. But I agree. It is vexing why arguments of sound logic and reason should be ignored.
The Imperium is better off without such fools, said Phocis Takar. Why should we waste time and energy trying to help those who will not help themselves?
Perturabo leaned over the plotting table, and Phocis Takar recoiled from the flint in his gaze. When the Primarch spoke, it was with the measured tones of a disappointed teacher.
For the same reason, I would not allow a child to pick flowers on the edge of a cliff, no matter how bright the blooms, said Perturabo.
For the same reason, I would not let you wander the minefields before this fortress without a Fourth Legion map and the training to interpret it. We must put aside such childish ignorance and do what is right. Now do you understand why we must help as many of Morningstar's people as we can?
Yes, Lord Perturabo, said Phocis Takar. I am in your debt for correcting my erroneous thinking.
Athava bit back his amusement. Phocis Takar was a seasoned scholar, but rarely did he ever admit to being in need of instruction. Even now, in the face of a Primarch's rebuke, his aura betrayed a measure of insolence. Magnus grinned and said,
Phocis Takar is at his best when dealing with absolutes. True and false, right and wrong. He excels at unlocking the structures of empirical formulae, but he will never be a moral philosopher or grand debater.
Perhaps not. And he's not the first to express such sentiments, said Perturabo. But I'll not have it said we left innocents to die when we could have done something to save them. You and I need to work together, brother. I need every one of your warriors tasked to this world's evacuation, not chasing relics and digging in the dust.
One squad diverted to the preservation of knowledge will not affect your timetable, said Magnus. The secrets this world might hold are too precious to be so easily squandered.
You really believe there is some ancient knowledge buried in Zarukin that will explain why Morningstar survived Old Night unscathed?
I'm certain of it, said Magnus.
In anyone else, I would say such certainty was arrogant, sighed Perturabo,
letting the data on the plotter table disperse like smoke.
When have I ever been wrong about such things? Asked Magnus.
Never,
admitted Perturabo, stepping towards the sheet-covered workbenches at the perimeter of the mezzanine.
But there is a first time for everything, and I need all your warriors on board. But here, I want to show you something.
The Primarch pulled back a white sheet to reveal a haphazard arrangement of half-finished projects, contraptions of mysterious purpose, and beautiful arrangements of gears and motors.
This is my workshop, said Perturabo.
It is just as I expected, said Magnus,
delightedly moving from bench to bench to examine the pieces lying around the edges of the workshop. He lifted a sheet of wax paper laid beside a partially completed model of a grand amphitheatre.
The Thaliacron, said Magnus. You've begun work on it.
Not yet, said Perturabo. Soon. When the crusade is done and we have heroic tales aplenty to fill it with song, then I'll build it. On the mountain,
across from Father's palace.
I will be there to see it unveiled, promised Magnus, and his enthusiasm for his brother's works was genuine and contagious. He and Perturabo spoke as brothers who had shared every memory from birth to this moment, yet they had known each other for only a few short years. Magnus had once spoken of how he and Perturabo had spent time together on Terra, recovering the relics of a long-dead polymath and unearthing arcana from the forgotten places of old Earth. Athava had thrilled to hear such tales, relishing every opportunity to learn more of his genesire. The obvious love between these godlike warriors filled the workspace with a swelling feeling of confraternity, a bond of brotherhood that could never be broken.
"This will be of interest to you, brother," said Perturabo, holding out a complex arrangement of curved metal, winding mechanisms and adjustable lenses. "I made a replica of the Antikythera, just like you asked."
To see so delicate a mechanism in Perturabo's hands seemed incongruous, as most apparatus bearing the stamp of the Iron Warriors that Athava had seen, save for those within this chamber, had been brutally functional. "Does it work?"
"I'm not entirely sure," answered Perturabo. "You never fully explained its intended purpose or how exactly it was designed to function."
"You've built it," said Magnus. "What do you think it does?"
"I believe it to be some form of navigational instrument," said Perturabo, lifting the device to look through one of its eyepieces. "It has the look of a sextant once used by seafarers, but with infinitely more dimensions to its operation. What manner of ocean would you be navigating to require such a device?"
"The great ocean," said Magnus.
"It allows even those without our gifts to perceive the realm beyond."
Perturabo nodded and set down the Antikythera.
"I suspected as much," he said with a sigh,
turning to lift something heavy from another part of his workbench.
"You remember what our father told us in the Hall of Leng, when he spoke of the warp and the danger of looking too deeply into its heart?"
"I do," said Magnus. "But this has nothing to do with that."
"It has everything to do with that, as well you know. But we will speak of this later."
Perturabo's arm swung around, and he smashed the delicate mechanisms of the Antikythera with a heavy hammer. The metal of the device buckled and split, the precision ground lenses shattering into a thousand fragments.
"Brother, no!"
cried Magnus, as the pieces fell to the floor.
"Why?"
Perturabo replaced the hammer on his workbench and said,
"Because I will play no part in aiding you in delving into things that you have been told to leave well alone. Our father knows more than us. He has seen further than us. If he tells us there are regions of the warp into which even he does not dare look, then we are beholden to accept that."
Magnus stared at the ruined device in disbelief. Such a piece was the work of a master, a treasure that ought to have been held up as the epitome of the craftsman's art. Athava saw Magnus's aura darken like blood in the water.
"Knowing what you suspected, you could have destroyed the Antikythera at any time after its completion," said Magnus with cold and controlled anger.
"But you waited until I was here to see you do it."
"Why?" "Because you needed to see it destroyed to truly understand."
Magnus let out a breath. "You have a cruel streak in you, brother," he said.
"Perhaps," conceded Perturabo. "But sometimes cruelty is the only way to make a point so clearly that nobody can ever mistake its intent."
The sky over Attar's Hab Towers burned with clashing magnetics. Hostile stellar radiation was stripping away the planet's atmospheric shield, transforming the night sky into a scintillating borealis of refracted light and billowing storm clouds. Twisted starlight bathed the city with end-of-days radiance. The highways and mass conveyance routes out of the city were jammed with every form of transport imaginable as Attar's people fled to Kalena.
The organization of the evacuation was under the aegis of Konrad Wagner's gubernatorial guard, but their breathtaking inefficiency had jammed every highway and transit route for tens of kilometers. Mechanicum provosts were attempting to unravel the gridlock, but it was taking time the citizens of Attar did not have. Lightning stabbed the city with fiery lances over and over again, and its industrial sectors were promethium hell pits of toxic fumes and chemical infernos.
Beautiful, is it not?
Said Magos Tancarix, watching the city die from the laggard safety of his gloss-red Triaros squadron to the north of Attar. Major Anton Orlov bit back a bitter response and took a calming breath that tasted of physoline, plastic, and burning fuel silos. He wanted to be angry at the Mechanicum Adept's singular lack of empathy for the people of Morningstar, but expecting emotion from a machine priest was an exercise in futility. Apparently oblivious to their suffering and loss, he was entirely more concerned with the opportunity to study the anomalous transformation of their planet. Instead, Orlov said,
"It's hard to think of something that's destroying my world as beautiful."
"The imminent demise of Morningstar is regrettable, of course," replied Tancarix, without looking up from the array of unfolded workstations integral to the structure of the Triaros. "But that does not alter the aesthetics of the storm, Major Orlov, nor the value of the data that will allow us to lessen our current meteorological uncertainty."
The Magos was, physiologically at least, less chimeric than many of his brethren. His face was entirely flesh, yet the back of his skull was a bulbous dome of mnemonic augments, cognitive boosters and coolant pipes. Every interaction Orlov had with Tancarix reinforced the feeling that any humanity the Adept displayed was a veneer, a mask that enabled him to interact with unaugmented mortals. A machine heart beat within his body, as did a ghoulish appreciation for beauty in devastation. Orlov knew it was pointless to argue with Tancarix, but couldn't help himself.
"Attar was once a prosperous city of seaborne trade from all over Morningstar," he said, pointing to a windswept headland overlooking the bay. "I grew up here. When I was young, I used to watch the ships coming in at night from just over there. It was mesmerizing to watch the aerial tugs guide the ships in, their prows ablaze with stablites and collision markers. I used to imagine they were starships, and that I was floating in the void, that I was absolutely alone and free. When I was drafted into the wrecked dragons, I missed that view. But any time I had leave, I'd come back here and watch the ships rolling in and out. It gave me a sense of peace and belonging, a sense that as long as the ships kept coming and going, all would be well. You understand?"
Orlov looked over at Tancarix, but the Magos was intent on the cascades of information scrolling down the Triaris' myriad data slates. His sentiment was falling on deaf ears, and he turned his gaze instead to the city's coastline. Far distant tectonic movement and hydrovolcanoes had split the ocean bedrock, and the sea had retreated thousands of kilometers. Beyond the flames engulfing the lower reaches of the city, Attar's vast docks were now towering white cliffs. Attar's once mighty fleet of oceanic harvesters, container vessels, and materiel conveyors lay toppled onto their sides, stranded like beached leviathans.
"All that is gone now," he said. "Forever."
"There are other worlds not dissimilar to this one," said Tancarix,
examining a brass-rimmed slate with a jumping needle with a look of puzzlement. He tapped a metallic finger against the glass, but the needle did not steady, and yet more joined its frenetic spiking.
"But this one was mine," said Orlov. "And I will mourn it."
Tancarix did not answer, too intent on the vexation his instruments were causing. Orlov saw the Adept's eyes widen, which was as close to an exclamation as he ever came.
"What's the matter?" asked Orlov.
"Incoming magnitude readings," said Tancarix,
"beyond the capacity of my instrumentation to measure."
"What does that mean?"
"It suggests an imminent seismic event of catastrophic power."
seismic event? You mean an earthquake?
Yes, Major Orloff, an earthquake, said Tancarix. One of unprecedented magnitude and with an epicenter only a few kilometers from where we stand. Omnissi, protect us.
Sour bile churned in Orloff's belly.
When?
Right now, said Tancarix,
as grinding rock and splitting stone twisted the ground and a thrumming bass note split the air. The headland where Orloff had watched the ships coming and going sheared away, obliterated in a thunderous avalanche. What had once been the seabed ripped wide open, and the burning sectors of Attar tumbled into a hellish, fiery chasm. Morning Star shrugged.